Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Businesses can screen for drugs all they want, but they still aren't immune from the opioid drug epidemic that has swept the country, and especially Ohio, which has been described as the leader in overdoses and deaths. The issue isn't just about employees, but also their families. And local and state officials agree that employers should be part of the response. Coming up, we'll hear from stakeholders on the employer side of the equation. A March 2017 report by the National Safety Council has shed light on the impact of opioid addiction in the workplace. We thought we'd get started with the president and CEO of the nonprofit National Safety Council, Debbie Hirschman. Welcome to the show, Debbie.
Good morning, Ann.
When we say that 70% of employers are feeling the impact of the epidemic, what does that mean?
Well, really what it means is that the drug epidemic that we're facing, particularly with opioids, affects us everywhere, at work, in our homes and communities, and on the road. And when it comes to what employers need to be paying attention to, is we often think about screening for illegal drugs or alcohol when employees show up to work, but people are much more likely to be impaired by substances that they receive either from their physician, over the counter, or are abusing or misusing, like opioids, in the workplace. So it's really important for employers to recognize this is a safety risk in their workplaces. It puts their employees and others at risk, and it's something that they need to have on their radar, whether it's pre-employment screening or on-the-job observation.
There's a dichotomy in your research. Most employers agree that drug addiction is both a disease that requires treatment and a justifiable reason to fire an employee. What about the employees who get addicted through treatment for a work-related injury?
Yeah, so this is a huge issue. What we want to really do is break down the stigma that's associated with this. And so on the front end, we want to make sure that employers understand that there are alternatives to opioids. And so this is important to have, whether it's through workers' comp, your health care plans, to make sure you have alternatives. And so what we did see in our research was that 88% are actually interested in covering in their insurance alternatives to pain relief treatment so that employees can avoid taking opioids. But only 30% of those, but the majority are not actually pursuing that. And so they're interested in doing it, but they really need to. We're facing, we're right at the front end of open season. People are negotiating with their health mm-hmm. insurance companies. They need to make sure that they have these alternatives. 70% said they would like to help employees who are struggling with prescription drug misuse return to their positions. But like you said, the dichotomy was that 65% felt it was a justifiable reason to fire an employee. So that's problematic.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the opioid epidemic and how it presents in the workplace. My guest right now is Debbie Hirschman. She's president and CEO of the nonprofit National Safety Council. They did a study reported last March about the impact of opioid abuse in the workplace. We're going to hear from the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation. We're going to hear from a lawyer who represents employers. We're going to hear about a public-private partnership at work in 18 counties in Ohio to address this issue in the workplace. In the meantime, we would like to hear from employers and employees who have faced this issue in their workplace. How have you responded? What do you make of, maybe there's an iteration of this that we don't discuss. If you want to bring that up, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you said that 88% of those surveyed said they were willing to use alternatives to opioids when it comes to treating workplace injuries. But one of the problems, but it's they're not actually doing it. And one of the issues is that opioids as a first response is the cheapest first response, right?
Yes, very often that can be the case, but in the end, it's actually very costly. If we look at what the costs of addiction are and recovery, certainly Ohio has been extremely hard hit by this epidemic. We understand that the costs, it can result in people not being able to work, losing their jobs, being impaired, being involved in car crashes. So the costs are very high in the long term when we look at addiction to opioids. But yes, you're right. Alternatives like acupuncture, massage, physical therapy, these can all help people manage and deal with pain or get through that recovery. We want to make sure that we're talking about things that might be acute issues that occur. People sprains, strains, hurt their back, hurt their knees. We want to think about how to take care of those in alternative ways. And another thing, just to make sure that we're talking about this, is that pain killers are not actually the best pain relief, and I think that myth really needs to be debunked. There's been a lot of research that a lot of people are asking for them by name, Vicodin, Percocet, OxyContin, but in many situations, a combination of ibuprofen and Tylenol, these are over-the-counter and much cheaper, can be more effective pain relief. So we need to talk about that too.
What role do the pharmaceutical companies play in all of this? Are they on board with the myths?
I think you'd have to ask them, but our research mm-hmm. at the National Safety Council has really demonstrated that there is a lot of misunderstanding about these painkillers that are out on the market that are prescribed, and that we really do have better alternatives to them, and that message is just not getting through.
Just 1 in 5 employers reported feeling extremely prepared to deal with prescription drug abuse in the workplace, and I'm wondering, even of those, are they really? Do they know what that means?
Yeah, so we know that 1 in 5 employers felt only 1 in 5 felt extremely prepared. So one of the examples of how they can fix that is making sure that they train their employees so that they understand how to identify addiction and signs of misuse. That is one of the things that actually was a very high marker for people feeling prepared. So training people to spot the signs of misuse, it could be missing work, lack of productivity, decreased morale, repeated near-miss incidences, uncharacteristic lapses in judgment, lethargy, or alternatively, extra energy, agitation or irritability, a positive drug screen or an arrest is a pretty obvious sign there. But we know that companies with training for all employees have experienced fewer incidents than those without training. And so it's really important for people to help not just their supervisors, but all employees spot the signs of abuse and misuse.
I would imagine there's an economies of scale that comes into play here. Smaller employers have to have a harder time dealing with this issue than large employers that can kind of do large trainings in one fell swoop.
So I would say certainly large companies have the potential to be able to exercise those economies of scale, but it's really important for small employers. And I would say one of the benefits that small employers have is actually their employees know each other. And so helping them understand how to spot the signs of abuse or misuse can be very helpful. Those direct interventions and those engagements can be powerful. And what we've found is if an employer is involved in addressing misuse, it can be much more effective than if there's an intervention at home or with the family, because the employer controls the paycheck, they control health care, they can require drug testing. And so we've seen greater success when an employer is involved when there is a substance abuse problem.
How much are employers reporting that it's the substance abuse isn't with their employee per se, but there's an extended family issue?
Yeah, so this is a huge issue. What we see is many people across the nation, 44% actually know someone who's addicted, and 75% of those who are struggling with a substance abuse disorder are in the workplace. And so whether they're working for you or whether it's a family member or close person to them, there's the issue of presenteeism, where they may be at work but not really engaged and not paying attention. There may be absenteeism issues, where they are having to address, if it's not for themselves, maybe helping someone else through treatment or dealing with law enforcement or other issues that may go along with that. This is a huge problem that affects people in the workforce, but also our friends and families. And those healthcare costs for addiction if it's an employee-sponsored, employer-sponsored plan, it's the dependents that also could potentially be costing the company as well.
The Republicans did not succeed in getting a repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act through this last time. But the iteration that they were looking at would have taken away the requirement for employee programs like that. How important are those things in the big picture going forward with this epidemic?
Yeah, so the National Safety Council did not support those revisions that would have made it harder for people to get treatment and get access to care when it came to dealing with substance abuse disorders. And so opioids are a big part of that, and we can't eliminate the access to treatment for those issues if we really want to solve this problem. I think employers have a tremendously important role to play here, though. What we've seen is our 13,500 member companies that are employers do take leadership positions, whether it's putting policies on for their employees not to use their phones while they're driving a car, it may be fatigue education. Employers can lead the way, even when state or federal governments don't have guidance. Employers can do that, and we've certainly seen that with drug testing, drug and alcohol testing over the years. That has driven down the rates of impairment on the job, and particularly in safety-sensitive positions. No one wants a school bus driver or an airline pilot to be impaired, but likewise, if you're working on the factory floor or even if you're driving to and from work, having a drug-free policy in your workplace can mean savings for the employer. The most important thing is looking out for your employees. They're your most important asset.
But as you said, most employers don't screen for legal drugs. It's more a lot more expensive. Who's to pay for that?
So actually, it may or it may not be. I can just share with you our personal experience. When we put out, we have a toolkit for employers, and they can visit nsc.org. Drugs at Work to get more information about this. One of the recommendations that we had was to increase screening for synthetic opioids on your pre-employment or your testing that you do. We do this at the National Safety Council. We went to our third-party provider and we asked them how much would it cost to go from a 6-panel to a 12-panel test. Mm-hmm. We could do it for no additional cost.
Okay.
So it's really important for employers to at least ask their third-party provider what it's going to cost to add the most commonly abused opioid painkillers.
The employer doesn't have the right when an employee goes into treatment for an injury, even if it's a work-related injury, right? They don't have a right to know how they're being treated, whether it's with a drug or with therapy or anything like that.
So they do have the ability through their healthcare plans to really manage some of these things. So, for example, some states through their workers' comp or some companies through their healthcare plans can actually manage some of these issues. Texas is an example. With their workers' comp plan, they actually moved some of these drugs into a pre-approval area. They were able to reduce the amount of drugs that were prescribed just by saying you have to get a pre-approval. You can still issue these drugs, but you have to get a pre-approval. Let's make sure you really want to do this. Other companies or healthcare providers can, again, encourage alternatives. They can monitor their doctors. And so if there's a doctor in the plan that's prescribing excessive amounts of opioids, there's the ability to go back to them and say, hey, you know, we're seeing you're much higher than other physicians. What's going on in your practice? Mm-hmm. We want to see this come down. There's many different ways to manage it, but I think having a drug-free workplace policy where you have your employees, particularly if you're in a safety-sensitive environment, they need to report if they are taking impairing substances. Whether they're legal or illegal is irrelevant. If they're impairing, they can put them at risk. And I think when people think about opioids, if it says it's not safe to operate heavy machinery, that means drive a car. So you need to think about your employees commuting to and from work as well.
Hmm. Well, Debbie Hirschman, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for covering this important issue. Stay safe.
Thank you. Debbie Hirschman is president and CEO of the nonprofit National Safety Council. We'll post a link to their study that came out in March about the issue of opioid epidemic in U.S. workplaces. Coming up, we're going to hear from our own Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation and how they deal with these issues. We'll also hear from a public-private partnership and what they're working on in 18 counties in Ohio. And then, of course, a lawyer who represents employers in Central Ohio and what some of the issues they're dealing with mean to the rest of us. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how the opioid epidemic has affected the workplace. A recent first-of-its-kind survey by the National Safety Council revealed that 7 in 10 U.S. employers are feeling the impact of the problem. Joining us now is Pharmacy Program Director for the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation, John Hanna. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, Ann. I'm awfully happy to be here.
And also employment law attorney with Fisher Phillips Law Firm in Columbus, Steve Lowengart. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ann.
And founder and CEO of Working Partners Systems, Inc., Dee Mason. Welcome to the show, Dee.
Thank you.
Dee, Working Partners has established a drug-free workforce community initiative in 17 Ohio counties. How much does the problem vary from county to county? Does it sort of look alike?
It does. In Ohio, we have found that it looks very similar, and we have 17 counties. This project, this initiative, has been funded by the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And the objective was really trying to get some realistic data on what is happening in the 17 counties. What are the perceptions? What are the attitudes? What practices are employers employing to take care and to deal with these issues?
What sort of measurements were you taking out there?
Well, we did it was from top down. We worked with communities, an interdisciplinary group of stakeholders in every community that involved Bureau of Workers' Compensation, Workforce Transformation, the behavioral health system, the Chambers of Commerce. And the objective was really to get all of the parties to talk to each other, find a common language, and to begin to work together to assess what the issues are, offer technical assistance to a nucleus group of businesses so that they could be operating best practice drug-free workplace programs and really could set the mark in the community, to work with job seekers who are potentially facing drug testing as applicants, and give them the opportunity to, for the first time, maybe question where they are with their use and how this is going to impact what they're doing moving forward.
So you have to hear those stories that we're all hearing about employers who literally cannot get enough employees because so many of them fail the drug test. And a lot of times you're sitting in your car, you're listening to the radio, and you're hearing this stuff, and you're like, why are people showing up to drug tests who can't pass the drug tests? What are they thinking?
It's what we have found, both our experience and then comparing national studies and et cetera, is that there's a breakdown and a difference between the perception and the reality of what's happening. The when we think about what is the lethality of opioids is dramatic. So we're all hearing that when Gallup or even in our experience, when we look to say, what are you perceiving employers is the greatest threat? They all say prescription drug abuse and heroin as number one and two. But when we really look at the markers that we have to rely upon in the workplace, which are different than what we look at community at large, mm-hmm. In the workplace we're looking at things like the age group of 26 and above and their, you know, who's used in the last month, who is in treatment that is employed, and what is their drug of choice, and how many positive drug tests are there. And what those markers are saying is actually in all studies, it's at about number three as far as what really is impacting the workplace. But then you go, okay, that's circumstantial and circumspect. Are those reality Are those good, real markers of how much it is impacting the workplace? What you talked about it in your earlier piece about the, you know, it's if it's a huge community problem, which it is, and we all know. Mm-hmm. So my friends and family are being impacted on the job. That's productivity and that's absenteeism, et cetera. We have, you know, how many people are not – How much is the applicant pool being diminished because we don't have people and they know they can't pass a drug test, so they don't even show up? Then we do have a slight increase in pre-employment drug testing. So there's that. Then there's folks that come to the job. They begin to have trouble with their use and they elect to leave. We don't even know, you know, we don't have a measure for that to know how much is that in the impact. And then lastly, what you already mentioned earlier is many of our drug tests, what we're seeing across the nation at the current time is the category of opiates are going down in positivity rates. And heroin is actually stabilized. But we're not really – less than 50% of employers across the nation are actually testing for the synthetic opioids that we're concerned with mm-hmm. in this section.
What are the – Steve Loewengart, what are the legal obligations of employer? Maybe I should take a step backwards first and ask, when did this start to become an issue in the law – in the business of law? When did it become a thing? I mean, drug testing has been going on for a long, long time. But as far as this iteration of drug abuse.
Well, and it's been several years now. We've been hearing from clients and dealing all across the country, but particularly in our – former Rust Belt office locations and along the East Coast, the abuse of prescription drugs has been just acute and overwhelming just in the past few years. So it percolates eventually to the lawyers and they ask for our help. And what we're advising is that although many of them have been drug testing and do have procedures in place, as Dee said, this is a particularly insidious problem. And I think as your first guest also alluded to, it's very important for employers, even though as in an at-will employment state, you can terminate employees, you can discipline them mostly as you wish, that doesn't equate to a lack of liability, particularly under the ADA. Because the problems that underlie some of this prescription drug abuse are disabilities. Alcoholism, it could be related, of course, drug dependency, mental illness, things of this sort. So you have to protect yourself, but at the same time, I think you have to take some responsibility, particularly if you want to keep an active and growing workforce and be productive and make profits for your company owners and your shareholders, you need to take responsibility for this problem. And that means education principally. From a legal standpoint, we often will recommend that employers that have policies or handbooks that talk about drug testing, and of course, if you have a collective bargaining agreement, that is an item you have to bargain for, that those be amended to specifically address the abuse of prescription drugs. And as I believe your first guest alluded to, it's very important to interface with the employees, tell them that they have concerns, put in a policy that if, as was previously stated, if you are using prescription drugs, that you have reason to believe might affect your job performance, that it's your obligation to come forward and reveal that and see if accommodations need to be made or if there is some other conversation that the employee has to have with its employer. So education, drug testing policies, and policies that again, state that this has to be a joint effort, that employees are to self-report. Now, obviously, one can't guarantee that that's going to happen. But if they've signed their name to the dotted line and if problems come up later, you're in a much better position if you have to go through the discipline termination process.
If you have self-reported.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, if I could just add real quick, Anne, last chance agreements are becoming very popular again. They always have been in union settings, but now even in the non-union settings, when you have a problem of this magnitude, you can't just terminate everybody that that has a problem.
I wanted to get to the last chance agreements in just a second. I'm glad you brought that up. The Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation started responding to the prescription opioid crisis, I want to say around 2009, 2010, started working on policies. What triggered that, John Hanna?
Actually, when I came to the Bureau, I was I'm the first pharmacy director that the Bureau has actually ever had.
All right.
And we established the pharmacy department as a freestanding entity in 2009 as a recognized department within the Bureau. Prior to that time, pharmacy benefit services had been handled in multiple areas across the agency. One of the things that I heard when I first came to the Bureau was folks speaking about injured workers being on boatloads of the narcotics and opioids. And I had to ask, is that a banana boat or a bass boat? What are we hauling here? So we began by creating we began by using the morphine equivalent dose as a common metric to measure opioid loads. In 2010, we looked at the creation of a freestanding pharmacy and therapeutics committee in order. Their first order of business was to establish and manage a formulary of drugs to begin to control the drugs that were covered by the Bureau for injured workers from the clinical perspective, not the physical perspective.
What's the difference?
Because if you handle appropriate medication usage properly for clinically appropriate reasons, the physical results will follow. And we've seen a $46 million decline in costs across the board in pharmacy at the Bureau over the last since 2011. So again, if you're using the drugs appropriately, you may be paying for a more expensive drug early in the claim, but it avoids long-term costs in that claim. If you control opioid usage on the front end, you don't have the legacy status. 24% of our injured workers in Ohio in the pharmacy benefit program are 65 years old or older. 15% of them are 70 years old or older. Our oldest individual receiving opioids is 98 years old. Again, we have claims that go back over 50 years in the Bureau. And it's these people, these injured workers, who were caught up in the transition of medical views on opioid utilization in the late 1990s. And they began using opioids by prescription almost 20 years ago. And now suddenly those injured workers are driving our utilization of opioids. Mm. That 24% represents 46% of the opioid utilization at the Bureau. And again, those folks have been on opioids in some cases for more than a decade. And handling their use and treating those patients is a very important factor that the Bureau is looking at going forward. How do we address our legacy claims? How do we help those individuals? We're turning off the faucet on the early opioid utilization. Our opioid use has dropped over 20% in new claims.
Mm-hmm.
But again, and I think we're in some ways a canary in the mine shaft for the state of Ohio in changes in how prescribers are looking at opioids, because we monitor them very closely. We're seeing shifts in prescribing attitudes earlier than perhaps other agencies or other payers in the state are seeing. But I do believe we are seeing a shift in prescribing philosophies among physicians as they look at opioids.
Jeff in Bexley, you're on the air. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. You know, I think that it's a good issue, but you're looking at it with a magnifying glass opposed to looking at it with a microscope. And this is how I see it. I think that I know a lot of labor people, and one of the big issues is how did we get there? Well, I think one of the problems is that there's a lot of overtime, and a lot of people like to work overtime because it's there. That doesn't mean that the job's going to get better. Then the people get stressed, they get injuries. That's a big problem. And it's really an unfair labor practice, because what they should do is they should hire more people and give the people, especially in labor positions, I'm talking labor, I'm talking hard work,
right,
every day, men and women shouldn't be working 60 hours a week on the floor of a plant. It has to change. And those people shouldn't be, the bottom line of a company shouldn't be greedy. And it shouldn't, you know, the Ohio DAS needs to really put their thumb on it and say, listen, this has got to change.
So you're going
more workers. Yeah. There's plenty of them out there. What do you think?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff. Jeff raises some interest. I mean, John Hanna, that has to have that issue of overwork, overtime, has to present itself at the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation.
We would see that on the pharmacy side when injured workers injure themselves and are treated for medications, then go back to work and continue to try to work those 60-hour weeks on a factory floor. Or even worse is they will be given amphetamine-type products to help them cope with the tiredness that they're getting from that job and the side effects of the pain medications they're taking. Our counterparts in Washington State, they have access to the pharmacy medication prescription reporting system on a broader basis than we do here in Ohio at the Bureau. And they found that over 40% of their new claims had received an opioid in the previous 30 days. So folks had been hurt or they had had some type of acute injury before their second injury that resulted in a workers' comp claim.
They're just going back too soon or going back too much. Yeah, Dee?
I have a question, John. Can you address whether or not Ohio is seeing a decrease in the number of workplace accidents over the years?
I believe we are, but I can't give you specific data on that aspect.
I thought I had heard that. I didn't mean for specifics, but thank you.
But our overall claims are definitely trending down.
Well, how does that, what Jeff and Bexley brought up, Steve Loewengart, how does that play into the legal liability of a company when it comes to worker compensation claims?
Well, there are some states, Ohio is not one of them, fortunately, but there are some states who are starting to pass laws that impose liability on employers if their, you know, general practices result in unsafe conditions for workers. And this could potentially be a problem within OSHA's realm, where they, under their general duty clause, I don't think you'll see it under the Trump administration, but you could see it if there's a change in the White House in the next election. They will say that this situation has resulted in an unsafe workplace and can impose penalties. But this is not a widespread trend at this point. It's an economic issue. We certainly can't solve that here today. I think one of the major points is that if you educate workers, if you train supervisors to recognize this type of problem and you intervene, you can help a lot of people who through treatment can get better. I think your first guest made the point that when the employer is involved, it makes a big, big difference in such a huge problem.
We are going to continue our conversation about the opioid epidemic in the workplace. So you just heard from Steve Loewengart. He's an employment law attorney for Fisher Phillips. Also with us, Dee Mason, founder and CEO of Working Partner Systems, and John Hanna, pharmacy program director at the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation. Employers, if you're out there, you're listening, and you want to chime in on this issue, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The opioid crisis has been described as the deadliest drug epidemic in U.S. history. Today, we're talking about how the opioid epidemic has affected the workplace. A recent first-of-its-kind survey by the National Safety Council revealed that 7 in 10 U.S. employers are feeling the impact of the problem. Joining us in the studio, Pharmacy Program Director for the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation, John Hanna, also founder and CEO of Working Partners System, Inc., Dee Mason, and employment law attorney with the Fisher Phillips Law Firm in Columbus, Steve Loengart. If you're an employer, have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dee Mason, we were talking about educating both employers and employees about this, and I'm wondering how common that is, what it costs to do that, and when we're talking about education, is that just a something on the bulletin board, or are we talking about real training?
Oh, I really appreciate this question. Thank you very much. When we're talking about a drug-free workplace and a comprehensive and best practice, we're talking about five elements, two of which are educating the employees and training the supervisors. What we found when we did our survey, and I can't talk about most of the details, but just to share that about 1 in 4 employers that we polled across 17 counties in Ohio said that they do any education, and the same amount, about 1 in 4, do supervisor training. The problem with that is that education, if you think about the workplace filled with adults, this is a captive audience that you can help adults understand how to use, how to deal with, how to ask questions, how to store, how to dispose of drugs properly. And a lot of folks say, okay, that is prevention. Prevention oftentimes is assigned to the youth, but adult prevention works. Secondly, with employee education, and why it's so valuable is that the employee, if they are a parent, you know, we know that the children of a parent who talks with their child about these issues is 50% less likely to use, which is incredibly important. And then lastly, it's like we really want the workforce involved through education and through support. If they are offering a second chance for the employee that's troubled and needs to get assistance, if they offer a second chance, the prognosis is increased substantially, because at that point the employee is getting support. They're helping the employer is helping the individual have a sense of hope and accomplishment and purpose and worth.
Yeah, Steve Loengart, you brought up the revival of last chance agreements, and it's getting pretty popular. And I want to get at what you mean by revival. When were they popular before? You said mostly through labor agreements?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And then they fell out of favor? They weren't as important? Or they're just the labor agreements aren't as prevalent as they once were?
Well, that's true. There are less organized labor workplaces. But last chance agreements used to be used in special circumstances, longtime employees, situations where there maybe was a discipline record that wasn't very well kept, and so employers were nervous about going the path of termination. So they would draft up these documents to make it clear, this is it. This is your final chance. And anything that you do that is within our handbook or within our work rules or within the – and if it's a union employee within the collective bargaining contract, any minor infraction will result not just in discipline up to termination, but will result in termination. And some employers who are faced with, you know, dwindling workforce choices that pass drug and alcohol tests, they're going this route as opposed to just applying the policy strictly to the termination point. If there is a reason that could be supported, they instead do the last chance, and that is just to try to retain their investment in training people and to try to cut down on loss of productivity through the churning of employee process.
Brenda in Circleville, you're on the air. Hi, Brenda.
Good morning. I'm an injured worker, and I've begun month 16 of dealing with multiple injuries from an accident at work. And I, you know, I'm frustrated because the process of getting approval not only from workers' comp, but also the MCO for the employer is so difficult. 16 months later, I still have had very little treatment. And so when you're talking about getting addicted to painkillers, I have to believe that's part of the process, a part of the problem, because people are in pain from injury for so long, where if you would do whatever's necessary, surgery earlier, therapy, those kinds of things that you're talking about, the therapy as an alternative, but I still haven't been approved for any of that. And so, frustration.
Yeah, that's Brenda, thank you. John Hanna, what about that sense of immediacy that a lot of people, when you're in pain, feel?
Well, the points that Brenda brought up are very good and very valid, and I can tell you that they are points that the Bureau is actively addressing.
Why does it take so long?
We are a state agency funded by employers. Every time the Bureau, under statute, we're required to only pay, we are expected to pay for medications, treatments, or salaries, yes.
Okay.
For situations related to an industrial injury. And those are charged to the employer's experience. It's a direct cost to the employer. We're not a tax-supported
agency. You're just
an
administrator, yeah.
And again, the costs for the employer are something that the legislators took into effect when they did the grand bargain between labor and industry in the State House back in 1913.
Mm-hmm.
The Bureau is currently, and for the last year, has been running a pilot in northeastern Ohio to speed up the treatment process for injured workers. On the pharmacy side, for immediate treatment, for acute treatment of an injury, we have what's called a first fill program, which as long as the physician writes on that prescription industrial injury and signs his name, the injured worker can take that prescription to a pharmacy and have immediate use drugs filled. They can fill opioids.
But if the doctor doesn't?
Well, if the doctor's not willing to say it was an industrial injury, then we can't. In that case, it goes through the normal process where a claim has to be filed and a validation approved between the employer and the Bureau. We have to say, yes, it's a valid claim.
And somewhere in that mix, people are living in pain and eventually maybe going and getting other treatments off the books.
If the doctor is not willing to certify that it
right. Is,
he's not willing to put his name on a prescription
right. Saying
this is for an industrial injury, I'd have to ask why.
Yeah, we certainly can't comment on the caller's situation, but it is, in some respect, an adversarial system. So it is possible that there is a dispute going on in her claim, which is delaying the treatment that she is requesting. And that's all by statute and administrative rules. And, we have a system. And workers' comp, as John said, is a carve-out. It is a bargain.
Is somebody who's injured on the job, unless they work through that system, can't they seek treatment somewhere else?
Absolutely.
Okay, they can, but not a lot of times
they
can't afford it.
Insurance, sure.
Right.
They have personal insurance through the company that would be one opportunity. That insurance company could subrogate then those costs back to the Bureau if the claim is allowed.
Okay. Chris in Canton, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Great show. I'm glad you guys are trying to approach this subject. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to bring up a point. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to bring up a point. What I've noticed over the years, over, I'd say, the past 8 to 10 years, it seems as though the skill level of the worker and the pay level of the worker seems to coincide with the amount of drug use that's rampant in the shop. And the lower the skill level and the lower the pay level, that seems like the more opioid use I've seen in a shop.
Hmm. Go ahead.
I'm now in a higher paying union job now, and you don't see that in there now. You know, people have more to lose. It's a better education level. I don't know how to explain it perfectly, but.
Okay, well, Dee Mason, have you seen any correlations like that?
I think we nationwide see a correlation between, for example, the food industry will have a higher rate of alcohol abuse, and then secondly, illicit drug abuse, and construction and manufacturing. All of these labor centers will have a higher rate. I'm not sure what to assign that to, and I don't know that there have been any studies that do assign that. Partly it would be because of turnover and the investment by the employer in employee education. If I have high turnover, low wages, I'm less likely to invest resources in educating those employees.
Which you say is a really important thing to
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely.
Chris, thank you for your call. You know, I read in a list of recommendations that an employee who suspects another of a substance abuse problem should go to the supervisor who should be trained in such matters. That's a quote from it. And I'm wondering, how do you know a supervisor? I'm going back to that small business issue. Who may be the owner is trained in such matters, and also what protections are there for employees who, for lack of a better phrase, turn somebody in? Steve Longart.
Well, I think one thing that employers can do is that they can include standards in their policies for how reasonable suspicion is determined, and it can be a pretty exhaustive list of things that either coworkers or management notice that would cause them to possibly have a discussion or possibly ask for an independent medical examination. Fitness for duty tests are certainly legal in certain circumstances where there's a risk to the worker's health or the health of those that are around him or her.
There are authorities that require employee education and supervisory training. For example, any federally mandated under Department of Transportation or even our workers' compensation program, the Drug-Free Safety Premium Discount Program. And in those cases, they will designate what topics should be dealt with, how long it should be, and also who, what credentials of the professional that's administering it. So that can help an employer identify resources.
And that's a financial incentive.
That's a financial incentive.
Yes.
In 2012, the Bureau of Workers' Compensation stopped coverage of OxyContin as a first-choice sustained-release opioid. I read that in a timeline of what the Bureau has done since 2009, John Hanna. And I'm wondering what you've learned about what that kind of policy and how it might get in the way of doctors treating their patients. Has there been conflict over that?
The way that we did that, and again, that's an outgrowth from our formulary.
Right.
In 2011, BWC created the first closed formulary in the nation. In other words, we put it in the Administrative Code of Ohio. So if the drug is not on the formulary, the only way it would get covered by the Bureau is the Industrial Commission, after a hearing, directs us to cover it in that claim, or it's a new drug that is of such therapeutic significance that we choose to cover it immediately for clinical reasons. We put in the formulary a tiered approach to sustained-release opioids. Sustained-release opioids, like OxyContin. OxyContin is the poster child for how a drug company can market a product and cause misuse of it, from the 1980s with MS-Contin to the 1990s with OxyContin. And we put a tiered process in that said if you choose to use a sustained-release opioid in your patient, you must first start with morphine sustained release. And if you choose to go higher, then you'd have to go to OxyContin with a prior authorization. If you choose to go higher than that, you'd need another prior authorization. We did that based on the clinical and the pharmacological aspects of those drugs. Remember I talked about opioid load measured by MED, morphine equivalent dose? Morphine is one. Oxycodone, which is the active opiate in OxyContin, is 1.5. It's 50% stronger on a milligram basis. Opana, oxymorphone, is three times the potency of morphine. Dilaudid, or hydromorphone, is four times the potency of morphine. So we simply ask, if a prescriber wishes to prescribe a potency increase in the opioid, or increase the opioid load of a patient, have some evidence for it.
John Hanna, Pharmacy Program Director at the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation, thanks for your time today. Also, Dee Mason, founder and CEO of Working Partner Systems, thanks to you as well. And Steve Lowengart of Fisher Phillips Law Firm, thank you for your help as well.
Thank you, Ann.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 MBR News.